Hello food followers everywhere and welcome to the first episode of season 5 of the Kung Fu Movie Guide podcast. My name is Ben Johnson and it is a privilege to be back with you all. I do hope you are well and safe and healthy wherever you are in the world listening to this. Before we get into it, I did just want to tell you all about this month's competition. We have teamed up with Eureka Entertainment here in the UK to give away 3 copies of their new Blu-ray release of Choi Hark's classic 1983 Hong Kong action fantasy film Zoo Warriors from the Magic Mountain. It's a wonderful film, and to be in with a chance of winning a copy of the movie, simply sign up now to our newsletter at kungfumovieguide.com. You can do this either by inputting your email address when prompted or via the homepage. Once you have then verified your email address, you will be automatically entered into our mailing list. Full competition details will be released in our April newsletter, which will be sent out on the 30th of April, so that's next Thursday. Become a registered Foo follower today and be in with a chance of winning a free copy of the amazing new Blu-ray release of Zoo Warriors. The Blu-ray really is fantastic. It's packed full of amazing special features and it is available to buy right now from Amazon and eurekavideo.co.uk. So if you're entering the competition, best of luck to you. Okay, let's get on with it then. This is episode 50 of the Kung Fu Movie Guide podcast, featuring a very special conversation with none other than Gareth Evans. So without any further ado, let's get on with it. Here we go.
Well, if you're really so determined to have a fight, then I'll oblige.
Hello, 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 food followers everywhere around the world. Welcome back to the Kung Fu Movie Guide podcast. Thank you all so much for joining me. It is an absolute pleasure to be back here again with you all for a 5th season of the show. And oh boy, what a great guest we have on the show today to kick off the brand new season of podcasts. I can't wait to share this one with you all. It's my conversation with the director of Moran Tau, The Raid and The Raid 2. It's none other than Gareth Evans. He is on the show today, a very exciting guest. I think you'll agree. I will get into the detail on all of this and how this conversation came about in a second. But first of all, I think we do need to address this damn virus, which continues to be causing widespread turmoil and anxiety pretty much everywhere in the world right now. I am speaking to you the day before this episode actually goes out on the 20th of April 2020, and I know that countries around the world are at different levels of lockdown at the moment. Some countries across Asia I know are slowly getting back to normal or some form of normality, and I know in parts of Europe shops and some businesses are starting to reopen. And also I realize that particularly in certain parts of America they're still very much in the thick of it when it comes to, you know, getting a handle on this thing. So personally, I just wanted to start by extending my heartfelt best wishes to you all, the loyal Foo followers around the world who do listen to this show. I hope you're all following the guidance that your respective governments are telling you to do. It is for your own best interests and the interests of those around you. And most of all, I just hope that you're staying strong, both physically and mentally. And most importantly, you're staying safe during these particularly strange times that we're living through. I'm going to be recording a lot of this from our little spare room here, here in the UK for the time being. It's just me and my girlfriend and the dog here in this flat, and we are still pretty much on a strict lockdown here in the UK. So I guess if there's any upside to all of this, I have been able to spend the last few weeks recording many conversations with people involved in martial arts movies, and I'm super excited to be able to share those conversations with you and release those throughout the year. If nothing else, hopefully this show can provide a bit of a distraction from everything that's going on in the world right now, and I do very much hope you enjoy this new season of podcasts. As always, the plan is to release new episodes every 2 weeks on a Monday, so in order to make sure that you don't miss a new episode, do make sure that you subscribe to the show using your podcast provider. You can also keep up to date with the podcast, of course, via our usual social media channels. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. So the last time that I spoke to you all, it would have been for our 2019 end of year show with Mike Fury. That already seems like so long ago. And so much has happened and changed since then. But anyway, I wanted to flag up to you all that Mike's new book, Life of Action Volume 2, is available to buy right now. I know that we talked about it a little bit on that show. Mike hasn't actually told me to do this and plug the book in any way, but he is a good friend and I know he's worked long and hard putting that book together. It's a great read. I'm reading it right now, and there's lots of great interviews with people involved in the action film industry. There's interviews with the likes of Zoe Bell, Michael Jai White, Frank Grillo, Kelly Hugh, Tony Jaa. It's an awesome book, and you can buy it right now from MikeFury.net and wherever it is that you buy your books. This also acts as quite a nice segue into talking about my guest on today's episode of the show. Gareth Evans is also featured in Mike's book Life of Action Volume 2. Gareth is, of course, the filmmaker behind a trio of Indonesian action films, which you may have heard of. Merantau from 2009, The Raid from 2011, and The Raid 2 from 2014. These three films helped to launch the careers of a whole new generation of action stars, including people like Iko Uwais, and they also helped to put Indonesian action cinema on the map, particularly in the case of The Raid and The Raid 2, which are two of probably the best contemporary martial arts films of modern times. That's not bad going for a young filmmaker originally from South Wales. We do explore his upbringing and his journey, which led him to Indonesia, which is where he lived for 7 years, before returning back home to Wales in 2015, which is where he still currently lives with his family. Gareth has since brought his highly visceral filmmaking style back to the UK, where he has explored new mediums and genres, most notably in 2018 with his British gothic horror film Apostle. That is available on Netflix now, if you want to check out Apostle. And he has a new TV series called Gangs of London. All 9 episodes of Gangs of London will premiere on the 23rd of April on Sky Atlantic here in the UK. That's this Thursday. Reading from the Sky Atlantic website, it says, Gangs of London tells the story of a city being torn apart by the turbulent power struggles of the international gangs that control it and the sudden power vacuum that's created when the head of London's most powerful crime family is assassinated. The show was co-created by Gareth working alongside Matt Flannery, his longtime DOP and a collaborator since his university days. And we should make a special shout out to the show's stunt coordinator, Jude Poyer, who does get mentioned quite a few times during this conversation. Jude did appear on episode 48 of this show, where he talks in a bit more detail about the action design on Gangs and also his work with Gareth on Apostle. So if you are interested in Gareth's films and his filmmaking style and you want to learn a little bit more about how he pieces action sequences together, then I do recommend you go back and check out my conversation with Jude Poyer on this podcast. This conversation was recorded back in early March of this year when Gareth was over in London, which is why we did manage to record this episode in person, face to face, back when that was a perfectly acceptable thing to be able to do. There are actually quite a few more episodes coming up in this season where I did manage to conduct face to face interviews just before the lockdown. This episode was recorded at my usual haunt here in London at the Actors Centre in Soho. So again, a big shout out to the people who run that place. Thank you all so much for being so accommodating, as always. And also a quick language warning ahead of this episode. There is a little bit of swearing in amongst all the kung fu chatter. So if you are bothered about that, or maybe if you've got small children running around, if they're on lockdown with you, or if they're in the vicinity while this is playing, then you have been warned. There is a little bit of swearing on this episode. Okay, I do hope you enjoy this one, Foo Followers. It was an absolute treat to be able to sit with Gareth Evans and talk to him in this way. It's quite a rambly conversation, but I do hope you enjoy it. It's a great pleasure to be back with you all. Thank you again so much for all of your support since you've been away and sending me loads of messages and comments on things. That is much appreciated. Thank you all so much. I'm going to stop talking now, and I'm going to hand over to my conversation, which was recorded in person with the great filmmaker Gareth Evans. Okay, let's just jump straight in with Gangs of London.
Yes.
This is yours and Matt Flannery's thing. It's based on a video game.
Yeah, so basically what happened was, probably just after The Raid 2 had been made and released and everything else, I was working on action design for a film called Blister that was going to be my first American project.
Sure.
And then subsequently that fell by the wayside. And then during the previs process of Blister, Thomas Bensky and Lucas Ochoa from Pulse Films came out to visit me in Indonesia, and they'd been pitching me the idea of Gangs of London, because I think they had the rights to the PSP game, but they kind of had an idea of turning it into a franchise of feature films.
Yes.
And that was really the initial sort of approach and initial concept.
So it was a film to begin with?
Yes, yeah, it was supposed to be a film to begin with. But then I had played the game on the PSP and I was familiar with it, but I wasn't so interested in doing like a film franchise out of it, because I just felt like London in itself, and one of the things I loved about London and traveling through London, the same as whenever I went to New York, was the idea you could be on any street and hear 10 different languages being spoken.
Sure, yeah.
And so we wanted the show, we wanted the world of this thing to feel quite diverse. And if you take that into a film version, in each film, each installment, you could pretty much only spend about 15 to 20 minutes with your sort of side characters.
Yeah.
It would end up having to be a centralized story that would take up the bulk of the running time, at least 2/3 of it. And so it wouldn't allow us to fully explore the sort of the richness of the diversity of a city like London.
Yes.
And so me and Matt then, Matt has always been a key collaborator of mine, not just as a DOP, but for everything I've done up until now, he's always been the guy that gets to read my first draft of everything I do. And
you go back to uni days with Matt.
Uni days, yeah. I mean, we knew each other since my second year of uni, when I needed to find a place to live there, and then he was looking for a roommate with another friend of ours from uni, and so we all shared a house together for a year.
Wow.
And that's how me and Matt first got to know each other.
Yeah.
And it was just a case of making short films and being like, here's a camera, can you please shoot this for me?
Yeah.
And because I knew he had an interest in photography, and that was sort of the starting point. But Matt in uni had a writer's background, because he was doing, he had one course where he was like to write a novel.
Sure.
So Matt always had a writer's background. So going back to it, I used to give him the scripts, he'd give me notes back on every first draft I ever written of everything.
Wow.
And so when it came to this project, I said to the guys at Pulse, there shouldn't be a feature film franchise. There should be long-form narrative. There should be a TV show, so that we can have episodes that shift the focus away from the central characters and focus more on some of the side characters, that we can explore the diversity, the cultural backgrounds of different characters more thoroughly than we would in a feature film landscape.
Yeah.
And they seemed really game for that. And basically, I had a concept for something that I was planning to do out in Southeast Asia before, but in Southeast Asia, especially in Indonesia, I would never get the budget to do this kind of show I wanted to do.
Sure.
And the concept for that was the idea of, you're in somewhere like, you know, Jakarta or somewhere, and this mob boss who has kind of ruled the roost over everyone and has kind of like held the peace between different factions of different people, whether they be from Malaysia or Singapore or from Thailand or from Philippines, so we could have all these different gangs cobbled together. And it would start with the funeral of that mob boss that maintained the peace. And then what would be the fallout of that? What would be the power vacuum that would emerge as a result of the death of this king? And so that was my initial concept. And I said, well, what if we transpose that to London? What if that's our central story thread? And so they responded to that. And then one of my big things then was the idea of talking to Matt and being like, I don't want to just send you the first draft of this. I want you to be part of it. I want you to be engaged in the storyline and with me. Figure out what we're going to do with the characters, the emotions, the family dynamics and everything else. So we both collectively came together as co-creators on the show.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we got to work and started. The very first thing we did was built a family, the map of a family, yeah. Family maps, I think. And then we put one of those up on the wall and we were able to say, right, these guys are going to be in charge of the heroin. These guys are in charge of racketeering. These guys are in charge. And then we started to delineate and look for where the factions would be, where the rivalries would exist, what were the relationships, who could be siding with whom, who could form an allegiance and an alliance, and who could be at each other's throats. And that was sort of really helpful then to sort of structure the overall thing.
Someone chose to kill Finn Wallace. Today we mourn the loss of a great man, but tomorrow it will be business as usual. Everything stops until I find out who killed him.
We wanted it to have enough that grounds it in reality, but we didn't want it to become something that would have the sort of, shoulder the responsibility of being a social statement. Yeah. So that was something we weren't keen on. Because we knew that what we were going to do was, take these, blistering action set pieces into sort of like the realms of sort of heightened reality, a little bit of fantastical sort of elements to them. Nothing beyond the sort of the style of action that we've done previous.
Yeah, sure.
But but even then, they stretch the sort of the logic a little bit. They have to feel like real fights, but at the same time, the endurance of the performers is such, and the sort of the duration of those fights is quite long. So then, by proxy of that, it feels more heightened.
You've got a great cast here. You're not necessarily working with fighters.
No.
Or people with a physical background. I know that you've done this in the past on Apostle as well. How can you do the style of action that you want to achieve and that you've set quite a high standard for, with people who don't have Ethan Uwais's background?
Yeah, I think for that, we just got very, very lucky.
Yeah.
One of the co-leads of the show, Shope Dirisu, is a phenomenal talent. We had all these great performers who were delivering amazing performances on a dramatical level.
Yeah, yeah.
And then Shope comes in and he's like playing one of the co-leads, Elliot. And part of the challenge with the character like Elliot was we knew he was going to have set pieces. We knew that he was going to have one-on-ones. Mm-hmm. We knew he was going to have big brawls. And so it was imperative to us that whoever was going to play that role would also, not just do the sort of traditional, here's your drama, piece of drama, now go and do an audition for it, but it was also, you need to do a fight assessment.
Yeah.
And so then Jude's team would come into play for that, so they would do fight assessments for us. And then Chris Webb, one of Jude's stunt team members, who's an incredible human being, I love him to bits, he went off and did an assessment on Shope. And so Shope came in and, he'd already wowed us in terms of his dramatic heft and stuff like that. And then, maybe 20 minutes later, Chris comes back down the stairs and he's just kind of through the window of our door giving a big thumbs up because Shope was just very naturally adept at handling action.
Yeah.
And so, whenever you do anything like this with someone who's predominantly an actor first, you start to look for it. It's the same like when we had with Julie for The Raid 2 and this Hammer Girl. I was always wondering, okay, well, how are we going to handle the stuff where we might need to swap out for a double?
Yeah.
For her, it was a lot harder because, we don't get that many female stunt performers in Indonesia we could use as a double. And she handled it 100% herself. But then, when you shoot in a TV show, you start thinking, right, okay, we might have to look for getting extra coverage with a double here and a double there. But Shope was so impressive that we were able to give him stretches of choreography that we really had no right to give him.
Right.
So, he's become this amazing sort of diamond that we've just kind of like, we feel like we've found this amazing talent now
who's
capable of everything, the performance, the drama, but then also the action as well.
Yeah.
We were doing scenes where we had one-on-one fights where for 2 days, because we were just shooting fight scenes all day for 2 days, that after about 2 days in, I was starting to treat him like a fighter. I was sort of expecting him to just, we'll go again then.
Yeah.
Not really treating him like I would with an actor where it's are you all right? Is everything okay? Are you comfortable? Can you go again? I'd just be like, yeah, you can do this. Next take. Let's go again.
Yeah.
And then you know, we would shoot a 4-day sequence where day three you'd always start with the end of the fight, because we shoot in chronological order for the first 2 days, and then on day three we shoot the very end just to make sure that we've got the end of scene, and then we work our way back then to get there, to make sure that if we do have to drop choreography, we know where we're pulling from, and we're not having to suddenly scramble and figure out the ending again.
Yeah.
We start shooting the tail end, and the tail end is where all the drama lay in that scene. And he comes in, and I've been treating him as a fighter, treating him as a fighter for 2 days straight. And he came in, and then all of a sudden I'm watching him the monitor, and he just delivers this amazing emotional performance. And I was like, oh, fuck yeah, he's an actor. Yeah. And then you start to get that reminder, then you're like, okay, this kid's got a huge amount of talent.
Yeah.
So I think I've become the sort of like the sort of honorary member now of the Shopee fan club. So yeah.
Working in television, I mean, that's a new thing for you. How did you find all that process?
So it's different. It's a challenge, I think.
Like on shorter shooting schedules, I guess.
Yeah, it's mainly the less days in a way. Yeah. But you know, that's part of the course really, and you kind of what we would try to do is not change our approach to film and action. But be realistic with what we thought we could achieve in that period of time. So if we knew we had a 3-day shoot, we knew that, okay, well, let's not go crazy and expect to get 60 different shots or something or other for a sequence, or go wild and knew where it stunts left, right, and center. Yeah. But we would pick the right moments to do the big stuff and then make sure that there was enough creatively interesting moments within those fights that, you know, they would stand up and hold their own then.
Yeah.
So we knew we were going to be doing something that was quite challenging and quite ambitious and had a lot of scope. And I guess for our side, we just wanted to be able to kind of like come out at the end of it and be like, when it came to the you know, at least for the episodes that we were doing, to be able to say, well, I think we've pushed the barrier a little bit in terms of what's considered action for television.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I mean, like, you know, looking back on some of the sequences, we were like, actually, we feel like for some of the sequences, we might have done that for cinema too.
Yeah.
So it was actually quite exciting to kind of be in the midst of that and be seeing it come together. I know we've got one sequence in EP5 where it's a huge siege on a house that we had no right doing that on TV. Like, you know, we just threw everything at it.
Yeah.
We were just going for broke at that point. We thought, fuck it, let's just push it as far as we possibly can.
I know in my conversations with Jude, I think he said that some of the work that he's done on this Gangs of London, some of the, you know, best that that he's ever done.
Yeah, I feel the same for some of that stuff as well. You know, there's certain sequences in there where they just stand up. I mean, I've watched them all like 1,000 times now because you just do in the editing process.
Are you in a place now, Gareth, where you can sort of pick and choose your projects, I'm guessing? I mean,
I'm horribly stubborn with stuff, so it's like, when I get offered things, I got to know that I want to make every frame of it before I can commit. So it's probably why I haven't taken anything which has been kind of like, you know, considered tentpole or big or anything. Not that I've necessarily been offered the big tentpole stuff, but it's like in the past, whenever I've been sent scripts for things which I've, you know, subsequently gone on to actually see come out and be released, it's always been, you know, if they're like 10 pages of a script that I just can't get my head around, or I can't sort of like respond or relate to, and it feels like there's not going to be any kind of budge in the sort of the writing of that, or if there might be a studio insistence, then I don't know how I could then direct those 10 pages of that script with any degree of confidence and commitment of knowing when I've got it and when I haven't got it, because if I can't see it, I can't direct it. So I'm a little stubborn in terms of that. So in terms of like picking the things I want to do, usually it's a case of, and up until now I've written everything that I've done, and so a large part of it is finding what's the story or what's the sort of idea that makes me passionate about it. So, you know, with Apostle, which was like a massive departure in terms of the stuff I've done in the past.
Absolutely.
It was partly a conscious decision of wanting to come back and do something that was different, play within a genre that I felt I had some experience with before, having done the short film for VHS2. So dipping my toes back into horror was quite fun. And then also the opportunity to play within a different sort of visual landscape, something that wouldn't be necessarily sort of, you know, the concrete of the city.
Exactly.
And also to play with tension in different ways, and not for it to just be about, oh, here's another set piece coming up.
Yeah.
So,
And I
Thor, I think that's such a brave but quite an admirable move to do that as well, because basically everyone wanted the Raid 3.
Yes,
And you must, even to this day, you must get sick and tired of people.
Not sick and tired. It's a weird thing it is, because it's like, I get it a lot, and I get a lot of comments. The ones that are interesting are the ones where it's almost like I owe it, or like there's like such a strong demand. Exactly. It's like, you know, how dare you make anything else? And I guess for me, it's like that part of my life has kind of passed now. I loved making the first two films, and I had a blast making them, and I love the people who I made them with. But I felt like there was nowhere really where I could take the story anymore. I had a concept for it, I had an idea for it, but it was such a departure from the first two.
Yeah,
I can't guarantee that the audience would have liked what I had planned for the third one anyway, you know? And enough time has kind of gone by now. I mean, it's been almost 6 years now since we released The Raid 2.
It's insane.
And so 6 years have gone by, and it's like, you know, the third would have picked up immediately after the second one. So it's like, I think everyone's got, well, I know I feel like I've got more than 6 years worth of age on my face. Yeah. So the idea of the other guys, I don't know. But
and they're ridiculously busy now as well.
They are ridiculously busy.
So there's that.
Which is great, which is like, it's a weird little source of pride there that they've, like, you know, to see the extent with which Ico's career has just skyrocketed.
Fantastic.
Has been incredible.
And
Yayan as well. Yeah, all the boys. And Joe Tasm as well, who's like in everything.
Exactly.
So yeah, no, it's one of those things. It's always a compliment. It's never not a compliment to have somebody want you to make a film that they want to see. I mean, you know, that's that in itself is ridiculously complimentary. But yeah, I think in a way, I've always had that thing in the back of my mind where I'm just kind of like, you know, I try not to respond too much to it anymore.
Yeah.
I used to be like, you know, oh, I'm really sorry, but no, I don't have plans for it now. And I felt like I was just angering people all the time whenever I'd said no.
Sure.
But
you're going to anger the internet anyway.
I think
anyway.
So.
That's
I think,
way
I think
works,
that's inevitable.
I think,
But I think for me, it's like, I always kind of want to, my sort of like inner reply is always, wait to see what's next, because you might really like what's next.
Yeah.
And whether that be Gangs or whether that be Havoc, I feel like we've got ideas, we've got things which are bubbling away, you know, that can hopefully be, you know, if they love The Raid, then they'd love this, you know what I mean? So
that sort of brings up another challenge, doesn't it? I guess if you've made your name doing The Raid 2, which has, you know, some of the best fight scenes, certainly in modern times, what a pressure that is. I mean, do you feel that pressure sometimes if you're going back into that world?
It's weird. It's like sometimes like I don't tend to rewatch them that often, but every now and then I might catch a glimpse of something.
Sure.
And so for me, it's like, I'll see things where I'm like, oh shit, we really nailed that shot and that cut. And you know, and I might see something and be like, you know what, I don't really know how I'd improve upon this one little beat here.
Yeah.
But there's like another 80% then where I'm like, oh, I should have tightened this up.
Really?
Yeah, I'll
even on The Raid,
I'll scrutinize the hell out of everything we do. You know what I mean? I'll notice the little, you know, half a second gap of someone not reacting properly yet, or I know all the stuff behind the scenes that we went through in order to make it. Like, I know that one guy who was playing one of the SWAT team guys that's guarding the door or something, or there's a sequence where Yandy, one of the other stunt guys, is charging down the corridor towards him, hiding a gun behind his back.
Yeah.
And then he pulls a gun out of nowhere and shoots him in the face. And the guy, you know, spotty spins and hits the deck. I remember when we shot that, because the guy who was given the reaction, he didn't give us a good reaction for about 7 or 8 takes. And by the end of it, we punched the camera in a bit closer, and I was stood behind him with my arms up inside his flak jacket, ready to pull him and yank him down on top of me, just to get the reaction. So, you know, it's like, it's one of those things where you see all these little shots where it's like, for me, I see all of the imperfections, and I see every inch of the artifice. So whether it's the set that didn't look quite right, or the movement of the camera didn't quite work the way we wanted it to, I can't not see those things anymore.
Sure.
In both The Raid and The Raid 2.
So when you were getting the type of reviews that came out when The Raid came out, I mean, were you surprised at that? Or
I mean, for the first one, for sure.
Yeah.
Like the first one, because it just hit us as much as a surprise as it did for the audience watching it, because we didn't know that what we'd done was going to be considered that special.
Yeah.
You know, we just felt like, oh Christ, that was like a long shoot and an arduous process, and hopefully everyone enjoys it, you know? But then, you know, I'll never forget the first time we screened the first film. it was amazing. It was such an incredible experience. We were in Toronto for the Midnight Madness, and you know, Iko was sat next to me, and then every time the audience would clap or cheer or respond, yeah, he would elbow me in the ribs. And by the end of the film, I don't think I had a rib left, because he was just, he just kept elbowing me the entire time.
He's got some tough elbows as well.
He does. One person you don't want to elbow you in the ribs is Iko. But I mean, we, you know, it was me, Iko, Matt, and Joe Tazin. We were all out in Toronto at the time, and you know, we spent the entire night just trawling through Twitter, just reading people's reactions to the films, and we just couldn't get enough of it. Yeah. We went to bed till about 4 or 5 a.m. Yeah, we just couldn't believe what was happening.
Attack!
You know, it's such a privilege anyway to be able to be to call what we do a career, to call it a job. It's absolutely insane. It's like, you know, I said to someone the other day, I said, you know, it's like I'll sit down in my lounge or you know, in my kitchen with the laptop on the table, and then I'll just decide somebody is going to say something or walk somewhere or do something, and then I'm going to convince someone else then to spend, you know, a huge amount of money to employ hundreds of people to go ahead and then make sure that that place I wanted him to be in exists, and then we're going to document an actor pretending to be that person who's then going to say that line. It's ludicrous. It's absolutely insane. That, and then not only that, but it's like we're going to then expect people to want to watch it. It's such a bizarre job. It's such a weird career, you know.
Yeah, for someone like yourself, who, you know, you're there in the process right at the very start.
Yeah,
that to you is crucial, would you say, to have that level of involvement right from the blank page?
Yeah, I think for me, yes. I just don't really know how to do it any other way. Yeah. It's the same when it came to the idea of, oh, I'm going to start making martial arts films and action films, like. You know, initially when I was in my sort of like late teens, early 20s, I thought, oh, I might make European art house films.
Yeah.
Like I was more interested in those films. I was more interested in, you know, Japanese sort of like, you know, dramas and sort of like, you know, pretty extreme stuff like with, you know, Kitano Miike and things like that. But I wanted those more sort of like, you know, obscure films. And so I never thought I'd be doing, you know, cool popcorn action films and stuff, you know, martial arts films. Like that wasn't really on my plan.
Yeah.
And then it kind of came to me, and then really the approach that I've taken for all of those films came out of a fear of failing at them.
Mm.
So the previous process and then designing the action the way we do, where we design it within an inch of its life, figure out the shots and the edits before we even step foot on anything called production. Was essential. It was a safety net.
Yeah.
I learned a lot by watching a lot of the guys who were doing, like, you know, YouTube channels and stuff like that, and doing their own independent action stuff. I learned from what they were doing in order to kind of attribute that to whatever I was going to make out in Indonesia. And really, that was the sort of the learning curve.
Was
just going out there and just practicing it.
Yeah.
I made a lot of, well, I think we made about 2 or 3 little test fight videos that we've never ever released online with Iko and some of the guys, where it was like literally me learning how to, first of all, operate this ridiculously large camera that we had. And then, you know, having the guys all turn up in the gymnasium, we just shot a couple of fight stuff, bits and pieces. You know, Yayan looks very, very different back then. He's super young and fresh-faced. And then we did another one in the underground car park of our office, where we shot down a different camera again. But it was an opportunity to kind of, you know, to learn and not worry about failing in those, because they were just really cheap and cheerful, you know?
Yeah, yeah. You're still in touch with Iko and...
I just spoke to him yesterday.
Yeah.
You know, we obviously talk every now and then, not as often as I think either of us would like, but, you know, but it's that thing of being in a totally different country and different time zones, and then, you know, every now and then I'll catch up and I'll be like, oh, how was such and such project? You know, or congratulations, are you doing this project?
Yeah.
You know? Normally it's him doing all this other stuff, you know what I mean? And he's like, what are you up to? And I'm like, oh, you know, I'm just writing. You know? But it's good. I chat to Iko and Joe quite often and stuff like that. I chat to Yayan every now and then. Obviously, I had Yayan and Chechep come over at one point a couple of years ago when we moved to UK to do a little short film. We did little tests of some stuff just to play with PG-13 action or something. But you know, it was it's good to kind of hear from them and see what they're up to and everything else. And
do you foresee a time of working with them again, do you think?
Yeah, I'd love to. Yeah. For sure. I think we me and Iko are always kind of, I think almost every single conversation we have, whenever we do talk, because sometimes it might be like a month or two where we don't talk for a bit, and then we'll catch up, and then we'll be like, oh shit, how are you doing? I haven't spoken to you for a while. How are the kids? And how are the family?
Yeah.
And then I think every time we end our conversation, it's always like, oh, we should work together again. Yeah, yeah, I got this story. And then he's like, oh, okay, how's it going with the story? I'm like, yeah, I'm going to write it soon, but I haven't written it yet.
Yeah.
And so that was even true of yesterday when I spoke to him last. I was like, I got the story, but I haven't written it down yet. I'll get on to it.
Yeah.
I'll get on to it. And I do have a concept. I do have a thing that I'd love to do with him. It would be very different. It'd probably be more of a period set thing.
Yeah,
so I think okay. I'd love to do that. Mm-hmm. I haven't tried that in terms of martial arts, to be honest. If I'm going to do full-on martial arts film, I'd love to do something that was more period set as opposed to something contemporary again, because I think I've done that 3 times now.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't mind having a bit of a different challenge in that respect.
And what are you going to do now? Try again?
You're from South Wales.
Yes.
What was your childhood like?
Amazing. Loving parents. Yep. Very supportive.
Yeah.
Never, even though when I was really, really young, I wanted to be an actor.
Yeah.
And then I realized very early on that I can't act. And so then I started writing and, notepads, just writing little scripts down. Not really knowing how to format scripts or just writing it down. And never had anything other than encouragement from my parents. Mm. Thankfully, we didn't have a video camera. So there's no existence of anything that, me and my friends were planning to do at that time.
Sure.
Because we were like, we were going to do remakes of things.
Yeah.
We wanted to do remakes of Fist of Fury.
Oh,
of
great.
Big Trouble in Little China.
Yes, yes.
All these things. And we were like, it was always the same thing. We just get together in my back garden or somebody else's back garden and then just, pretend that we were Bruce Lee. So I put on my plimsolls and vest and black tracksuit bottoms. And my mate would pretend to be the sort of the German guy with the curly hair.
Yeah, great.
So we would do all of that stuff. And then, but I just, grew up gradually. I didn't learn to drive for a long time. So when I was like 17, 18, I never really asked for like, oh, can I get a car?
Yeah.
It was, can I get a camera? And that was the first thing I wanted. So I remember getting my first VHS-C, compact VHS camcorder, and then just being able to suddenly shoot things and just, film whatever the hell I could find and whatever I could. But I didn't have any way into the industry. So uni helped with that.
But you were into martial arts films?
Yeah. So every Saturday, or every other Saturday at least, would involve a trip to go and see the local rugby team, Neath, play rugby.
Yeah.
My dad's a massive rugby fan.
Sure.
But my dad's also a huge fan of cinema.
Yeah.
And my dad introduced me to world cinema. He also had an appreciation of of Kurosawa and of, some of the martial arts films well.
Sure.
So not as big a fan of me as about me when it comes to martial arts, but he introduced me to them.
Yeah.
So, every Saturday would be on the way to the rugby would be a quick stop at the video shop.
Great.
And then, we'd get to pick one or two films for the weekend.
Yeah.
And then, you come home from the rugby and then first thing I couldn't wait to do was just to put one of the videos in and just play and watch.
Yeah. We're talking Hong Kong stuff here.
My dad was the one that introduced me to Armour of God and Police Story.
Fantastic.
I remember when he rented
That's Police... great parenting.
It's really great parenting. He's amazing. I remember when my dad first rented Police Story, I didn't know there was a Jackie Chan film because he just popped in the video shop. I had to wait in the car with my mum. And he came back, and back then, you wouldn't get the actual case. You'd get, the video shop case.
That's right.
And then when I opened it up and it said Police Story, none of that screamed Jackie Chan.
Yeah.
I mean, I just thought, and I remember saying, I don't want to have an American action film, Dad. And he just knew that it was a Jackie Chan film, but didn't tell me. So he was like, no, it's my choice tonight.
Yeah.
And so off we went to the rugby, and then I moaned probably the entire day, the entire way through the game. Came back and he was like, right, should we watch Police Story? And I'd be like, no, don't want to watch it. And he knew. And so he just put the tape in and he said, come on, sit down and watch it with me. And he pressed play and then all of a sudden, up became the boom, 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 boom.
Yes.
And I was like, wait, it's Golden Harvest? And I recognized the logo immediately. Yeah. And then when it said a Jackie Chan film, that was it. Like, I was just like, I couldn't be more attentive to the TV then.
Yeah.
And I think after watching that, that was like a life-changing viewing. That film just blew my mind in terms of, oh my God, action films could be like this.
Yes, yeah.
The dance of it.
It's a modern day film as well, isn't it? But were you into the old school kung fu stuff as well?
I was. Yeah. I appreciated, I kind of, because I think my first way in was through Bruce Lee initially.
So
the first thing was like Enter the Dragon, which is like probably the biggest cliche that you can say, but it was the first thing.
But it's true though, isn't it? That's
it was the only one that it was the only martial arts film that a friend of a family member or the parents of a friend would have owned,
yes,
or would have had,
yes,
recorded or something like that, you
exactly
know what I mean?
People who weren't into martial arts, yeah, films knew Bruce Lee and knew that film.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, you know, it was one of those at a friend's house, and then their parents are just like, oh, just put Pan to the Dragon on.
Yeah.
And then I was like, wait, what's this? And then suddenly there's this real life superhero,
yeah,
up on screen,
yeah,
which blew my mind. But so you know, Enter the Dragon was still contemporary, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
All of Bruce Lee's films were contemporary,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
to a degree, the 70s, yeah, set, but you know, the contemporary still.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
And then with Jackie, the first, actually weirdly, the first Jackie Chan film that I saw was only the first 15 minutes of Magnificent Bodyguards.
Right.
I remember it being like, oh, who's this guy? And then...
Why only the first 15
minutes? Because my mum came in right as James, I think it was James Chan, had just chopped off some guy's arms,
yes,
and sliced his face off.
Sure, yeah.
And out came this guy missing his arms and,
yeah,
like half his face is hanging off.
Yeah.
And my mum, who's always been pretty squeamish when it comes to violence, so God bless her when it comes to the stuff that I make, just came in and was like, turn this off right now.
Yeah.
Switched it off, ejected the tape, and she said, no more Jackie Chan films in this house, because she just thought that that's what his stuff would be like.
Yeah.
So when my dad brought Armor of God in, mm-hmm, which was my next Jackie Chan film, the first, yeah, one I watched from beginning to end,
yeah,
she was like, oh, Jackie Chan? No. And my dad was kind of like, no, wait, because this is supposed to be really good.
Yeah.
So let's give it a try.
Yeah.
And then that was it. It was like off to the races end. So like contemporary mainly.
Yeah. Yeah,
and
yeah,
then, and then for me, like, you know, I know loads of people who kind of like sing the praises of like Drunken Master and love that film. And I love it too. But it wasn't the first one of that kind that I fell in love with.
Yeah, it didn't connect.
For me, it was The Young Master.
Yeah.
Because that was the first one I watched,
yeah,
of that era, of that kind of, yep, period set and thing for Jackie Chan. I just remember absolutely adoring every second,
yeah,
of that film. I thought,
yeah,
it was incredible. I thought the stunt work was good, the,
yep,
humor was funny, and the final fight on the mountaintop was just amazing. It was,
yeah,
just incredible. And,
yeah,
Wang Yin-sik, I've always loved his martial arts skills.
Great.
I've always,
yeah,
it was incredible.
Yeah.
So for me, Drunken Master was probably pretty late on for me,
mm,
in terms of having already discovered Jackie and seen a lot of his work.
Yeah, yeah.
So I don't have the same love affair with that film as I do,
yeah,
with something like Young Master or even Dragon Lord.
Do you still draw from those films, though, in the work that you do now?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, we do. Like, I mean, like, I loved working with Iko when I was out in Indonesia,
mm,
but then now, obviously, I've been working a lot with Jude.
Yeah.
And what I find is with Jude is like, because he has a very similar sensibility to me when it comes to like, you know, what we love in terms of action.
Yeah.
And so when we love what Jackie does, but we both love it when Sam was doing it. When
yeah,
Sam was choreographing and stuff.
Yeah,
it's just got an extra bite to,
yeah,
it.
Yeah.
And they feel like real fights.
Yeah.
So, and then that's been the sort of the remit. That's always been the sort of the thing that the ethos that we've kind of like conducted ourselves with when it comes to the action design. We always say, oh, it can be really, you can have stylish moments, but it's got to feel like a real fight.
Yeah.
If it doesn't feel like a real fight, then it doesn't get to,
yeah,
be part of the choreography.
Yes, yes.
So that's been part of the fun of designing stuff with Jude, is that we always go back and we always look at those films. I mean, the golden era of 80s and early 90s.
You can't.
And, you know, Jude's always kind of like, you know, showing me some stuff, which, you know, Jude's encyclopedic in terms of his knowledge,
sure,
of that kind of stuff. So I always feel like a charlatan when I'm around him. I feel like I don't know anything because he's showing me films I didn't even know existed.
Yeah. Well, he's probably in half,
yeah,
of them as well.
Yeah, that's true. we found a lot of... That's the one fun thing as well. It's like it was all of his mates who, like, still like Mike Leader and stuff out in Hong,
yeah,
Kong. Every now and then they'll just send me this weird picture of Jude in some terrible commercial. So some commercial that he did. And then I get to forward him to him and we just take the piss out of each other all the time then.
Your kung fu expertise is just not good enough.
There are three steps which kind of made me realize I wanted to do something through the film. I knew I had to do it. It was the first time I saw Boogie Nights I was in the cinema. There was the scene with Alfred Molina when they were doing the drug deal with the kid walking around setting firecrackers off.
Sure.
And it was so intense that this audience that had been laughing throughout the film and enjoying it and feeling like you're in this sort of like party environment, this atmosphere, suddenly in this one scene while Jesse's Girl is playing on the cassette and all that, everybody was just silent and on the edge of their seat.
Yeah.
And I remember it was this weird moment where I hadn't noticed it before in any of the film, but I was just sat there and I just suddenly became really aware of the power of what this film was able to do to a collective group of people. It was probably like 300, 400 people in that screen, and we were all experiencing the same thing where we cared about the characters, we'd been dragged into the story, and now we were sat there on tenterhooks waiting for something to happen.
Yeah.
And I just remember thinking, oh my God, I want to be able to make people feel that way about something.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just a subconscious thing at the time. Then fast forward probably like a year or two, and I remember being in uni, probably second year uni, and then on TV they screened Full Tilt Boogie, the documentary making of From Dusk Till Dawn.
Yeah.
And you know, I'd never had an insight into what a film set was like.
Yeah.
No clue. So suddenly I was like, okay, well, this is what making films is like. Oh, wow, I quite like this. This sort of this social aspect to it. And that everyone's kind of working hard together to create something, you know, whether it be something really serious, like, you know, another behind-the-scenes thing was Magnolia, which really blew my mind.
Yeah.
But then, you know, something very serious like Magnolia, but also something really fun and pulpy like From Dusk Till Dawn.
Yeah.
It's all the same work. It's all the same amount of hours and the same amount of people. And that kind of like struck a chord with me, and I was like, I want to know what that feels like. And then when I did Footsteps, then when I was probably like 25 when we shot that, 2005,
so
we shot
that, it, 2005,
it came out,
yeah, 2006,
it came out
2006, yeah.
We shot it 2005. I just remember, because I took a sabbatical from work for like 2 months in order to shoot that thing. I had a really cool boss, like Alan Reese, God bless her, she's not with us anymore. And she let me have time off from work. It was called Aken. They used to do sort of like Welsh language CD-ROMs or videos,
sure,
and
yeah,
online courses.
You speak Welsh?
That. Unfortunately, I know I do not.
No.
I do want to learn it. I really feel like not like a personal pressure to do it. I just really want to.
Yeah.
There's something about being away in Indonesia that made me, you know, more in touch with sort of like my patriotic side. But
you have a thing with languages, because wasn't your first short film was in Japanese?
That was because I was just obsessed with Japanese cinema, and I used to run a website. I used to do reviews for Japanese cinema called jpreview.com.
Great.
Yeah. They were the
Are
best.
Still out there?
No, the site's defunct now.
Sure.
I might have the entire website on a floppy disk somewhere.
Yeah, yeah.
So long ago it was, you know, it was in its infancy. They were the best written reviews in the world. I just loved doing it, and I was obsessed with Japanese cinema, and so I used to review films all the time. It was one of these situations where I was learning Japanese anyway, because my wife's family are Japanese Indonesian.
Sure.
And I'd been taking an interest in Japanese culture because I was so interested in the films and the cinema. I wanted to learn the language. And so I was learning at a university, then I'd do night courses, classes and that. But then at the same time, I would meet one of the students from the university there, and we would sit down and chat for an hour or two, and she would help me do conversational Japanese.
Great.
And then I just mentioned to him in passing, I said, oh, I've written this Japanese samurai short story, da, da, da. And I gave her the script to read. Well, before I knew it then, she was like, oh, a few of her friends were interested in maybe being in it. And I was like, oh, wait, oh, I didn't know I was going to make it.
Yeah.
And then so suddenly it was like, I'm never going to have this opportunity again.
Yeah.
So it was get the script translated into Japanese, get the cast, all like Japanese students who just happened to be based in Cardiff, thank God, a lot cheaper. And then it was like, it was the weirdest thing then, where I bought one sort of like Hakama type outfit, samurai outfit, from like some fancy dress place in Japan.
Yeah.
So I got that imported. And then my mum then to go off and get loads of material so she could make multiple versions of it and take the stitching, take the details, take
That's
the shape
fantastic.
Of it. And she went off and made loads of these, like the outfits, all the outfits were made by her. I got to give her credit because I don't think I gave her enough credit at the time, but she really, really went above and beyond in order for me to help make that thing.
That's cool. That's
and it was
really cool.
Just, you know, kendo swords off eBay.
But really, so, that's a warm-up for once you're in Indonesia and the translating and then getting, obviously, making the three films you made there in Indonesia.
Yeah, it's a weird thing because it was like, with the exception of Footsteps, every project then from, like the short film before with the Samurai one, and then Maranta, The Raid, and The Raid 2, And then parts of VHS 2, because some of that was in English, but yeah. Parts of VHS 2, my script, everything I'd written was being read back to me in a foreign language. Yeah. It was the weirdest thing, because it was like, you know, you listen for that intonation, and you're almost like, the scripts are almost like the subtitles then. While I'm watching the performances on the screen, I had the benefit out in Indonesia of having a great assistant director named Plontong, who was like in charge of all the fighters. So much fun. Like, he's crazy. He's absolutely crazy. But he'd be great with the performances, and he'd be great at sort of like working with the actors with me. So he knew what I wanted, and then he would go off and give them those notes. I lent on people a lot out there for that. But I think when it came to something like the Raid 2 then, for a lot of the actors, by the time we got to the Raid 2, a lot of those actors, they were all fluent in English. Yeah, so like Oka, Alex, Julie, Iko at that point had really good English. Yeah. But then also, you know, in respect of that, my Indonesian was starting to get better. And weirdly, the Indonesian pushed the Japanese out of my head. So now my Japanese sucks, but my Indonesian is better.
Indonesian's pretty good.
Yeah. Well, it's been about 6 years now since I've needed to use it. So yeah, maybe it's not so good anymore, but yeah, I'll find out.
It's the butterfly style.
You went out there on an assignment. You had a job there to film a documentary. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I mean, no bones about it. I think the project came as a result of my wife, really, because I was working on.
Your wife is from Indonesia.
From Indonesia, yes. Yeah. And basically, through her contacts back in Jakarta, she knew that what I wanted to do was filmmaking.
Yeah.
And after Footsteps, which was, you know, small independent low budget film, didn't really, you know, set the world alight, she could see me kind of drifting back into the sort of the comfort and security of what I was doing for my 9 to 5.
Yeah.
And then this opportunity came up where they were looking for somebody to direct a documentary. They wanted a foreign eye, and that it was to do with martial arts. And back then it was like, well, you're kind of into martial arts, aren't you? You're kind of interested in that. And I was like, yeah, I mean, I grew up watching a lot of kung fu movies, you know what I mean? And I kind of sort of practiced a little bit before, but not much when I was a child. Yeah. And then when it came to the documentary, it was like, it was almost like it was offered on a plate. So I think I got very, very fortunate with that.
Mm.
So I think it was like through, it's a lot of it was through who you know.
Yeah, and but it seems like it was almost destiny in a way.
Yeah, I when I look back now on the sort of the steps that led to me getting to where I am now.
Yeah.
So much of it is just like, if I hadn't, you know, if me and my wife hadn't met, you know, then I wouldn't have really known anything about potentially Indonesian culture.
Yeah.
To the degree which I know it now.
Yeah.
And so I went out there to do that documentary. And she was my production manager on it. So she was kind of like helping run the ship.
Yeah.
Matt came out to help operate one of the cameras.
Great.
I operated the B camera. He operated the A camera because he's better at it. And he's continued to be better at it, thank God. Yeah. Oh, he knows that anyway.
Yeah.
And we went out, and it was a six-month job where we went out, we recce'd, we researched.
Yeah.
Shot for like 5-6 weeks, traveled to 5 different parts of Indonesia, which was fascinating, to go to Sumatra, to go into Jakarta, to go into West Java, Cianjur, and all these amazing places, and meet these incredible people that their lives had been touched by silat in some way. You know, and it wasn't purely about the martial art, you know, as a self-defense or a philosophy. It was about how it can function in society as well. So we really, really learned I learned a huge amount in that process, you know, far more than just the benefit of meeting the people I've met,
yeah,
you know, that have come into my life and the work I've done since, but, you know, seeing CLAT being used as a tool for rehabilitation for people with drug and alcohol addiction. It was absolutely amazing to kind of be in this one place. It was fascinating. But then, you know, obviously the other side of it is that it introduced me to people like, you know, Edwell, who was, you know, one of the choreographers for Marantau, Yayan, and Iko, and Chechep as well,
yeah,
who I'd met in the process of doing that documentary, who was somebody who was just like, blew our minds, but we just couldn't figure out where to put him in the first two films.
The thing is, they've got such screen presence.
Yeah.
You must have felt, when you met them, got to know them, because Iko was working as a driver or something.
He was like a delivery guy for a phone company. So he'd be like, you know, shipping letters and documents back and forth between offices. You know, and I remember when we first met him, all of our research footage kept focusing on him. We all zoomed in on him. We all were like, oh, this kid's really interesting.
Yeah.
And, you know, back then he was like super skinny. He wasn't like buff or anything like that. He hadn't gone into his movie style looks like he's got now. But back then he was just like this skinny kid that did see that. But he just had there was something about his eyes and you couldn't take your eyes off him.
Yeah.
And I was like, this kid's amazing. And then, you know, we did a test with him. We never were going to include him in the documentary, and I don't think we did. But we just spent an afternoon shooting with him where it was like, oh, we're going to just film you driving your car. And then we're going to take you to, you're going to take us to your office, you're going to walk us through there. We just film you, it's like observational stuff. So just keep a straight face, just pretend like you're doing that.
Yeah.
And, you know, take your seat at your desk and just do what you would normally do. And, you know, while we're filming him, obviously what you don't see is behind the camera, all of his mates are kind of ribbing him and trying to shout and make him laugh. And he kept straight, he kept a straight face, and he was focused, and he was like really like, you know, you know, he had a focus to him that you don't normally see.
Yeah.
And so I remember saying to Maya, I was like, oh, this kid's got an amazing, you know, raw potential here.
Yeah.
I think we could do something with him. I think we could do something that's really good for the martial art as well as him.
Yeah.
And so that led us to do Maranto then. On TV, C-Lab was basically some mystical bullshit thing where it'd be like people jumping up and turning into a panther or, you know, or shooting fireballs and stuff like that. And it was kind of like, it was kind of, felt disrespectful. Our first announcement that we were going to do a C-Lab film was derided. You know, it was because it was seen as nothing to be taken seriously.
Yeah, yeah. That was in Indonesia.
Yeah, in Indonesia, and you know, some people didn't like the idea of a foreign filmmaker touching something that was close to their culture. I guess they thought I'd be disrespectful to it, but I just looked at it. How much more disrespectful could I be compared to the way the TV had treated it?
Yeah, yeah.
Also, I was Dutch back then for some reason. No one could say Gareth or Wales. I was Gerard from the Holland for some weird reason. I don't know what I was about. Colonial thing, I think. And then, so I kind of... Yeah, we set it up and we worked very much under the radar. No one really took it seriously. Took us seriously. Mm-hmm. So we took it seriously, but nobody else took us seriously. And we just went off and made this film. And then when it came out, you know... Maranto didn't do a huge amount for us on an international level. Yeah. I know there were fans of it. I knew you had a release here and a release in the US, and that people kind of, you know, responded to it. And we definitely rode the coattails of like On Back in terms of being able to be considered like, oh, here's the sort of the next place in Southeast Asia which can do martial arts films. Yeah. But locally, it actually got received quite well. Like, it didn't blow the box office wide apart like we hoped it would.
Yeah.
But... people were very pleased with the film because I think at least in the Indonesian cut, because in the international cut's about 25 minutes shorter, and in the Indonesian cut, there's a lot more, and a lot more of that is front facing. It's all in the beginning, the first 30-40 minutes, where we added a lot more cultural elements in there.
Yeah, yeah.
So a lot more about the traditions, you know, things that meant something to the local audience there.
You must have had a vision there for, you know, how you wanted to approach the action.
Yes, and on Maranto, to be honest, like, I mean, on Maranto we did a lot of long takes, longer than I would do now.
Yeah.
And I think that I learned that as a result of Maranto. I learned that mainly because Mike Leader told me I was doing something wrong. And I was like, yeah, you're right. Because we were burning them out. We were burning everyone up because it was like, look, just repeat, he can fight two or three people in a take, but not every take.
Yeah.
And then instead of fighting six people in one shot where the moves get sloppier, you know, and you can see it. And also, if I'm so wide and just floating with the camera around, then there's nowhere to hide some of the sloppiness else. And so, you know, some of the stuff in Maranto, like we were talking earlier about, like, looking back on your work, and there's a lot in Maranto that I watch and I'm like, oh, if I did that now, I know exactly what I'd do differently.
Sure,
you know, shot by shot, cut by cut, the methodology of it, you know, and stuff like that. When we designed the choreography, I spend time with them when they're designing it. So I want to know the method behind everything. Yeah. I want to know why are you going for that wrist block there? Tell me why.
Mm.
So I can see if there's something about your body shape or body movement that's interesting for me on a visual level that I want to capture with the camera.
So
I need to understand it to that level and that degree so that I can be like, oh, okay, so why are you doing this? Right, okay, so if the camera's here, I can see that. Or I can see now that you're going to notice that his leg's going for you and that's why you've blocked it. Okay, now I get it. If I understand it from that level of detail, then I can now show you who is not in the room with me for 6 months figuring out, but I can show you something that feels like you understand the fight. Just the other week I was with Jude and Chris and we were just sitting around chatting. There's a piece of choreography in the Raid 2, right?
Yeah.
That I knew was hokey when we shot it, but they have flagged it up every single time, which is there's a bit in the warehouse where Ika's got all these guys chasing after him and he's like he's fighting, he's driven a car through there and all this shit's happened. And then he gets up and he picks up these two empty water, you know, the what you call them, the water jugs you get, like, you know, the water cooler jugs. The two empty ones. And he grabs, he just like hurls them at these guys who are coming at him just to kind of get him to disperse a bit, right? And what happened is that one of the guys who gets like clattered with one of them, then he was supposed to get clattered, but then Sidestep still chase after Ico so that Ico could then pull a big wall of shelf units on top of the three other people who were coming there. And that was supposed to be the thing that took him out. But for some reason, this guy acted like he got knocked out by this empty water cooler thing, the jug. And so ever since then, they've always taken the piss out of that one piece of choreography. So if we're walking past anywhere and there's like an empty water cooler, the two of them are always like, whoa, 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 watch out, watch out. Those things are dangerous. Those things are lethal.
So you've got guts. But I'm going to bury you alive and jump on your head to revenge our sister.
The Raid was a sort of means to an end. Is that fair to say? You wanted to make the Raid 2, what turned out to be the Raid 2.
Yeah.
In order to get the financing for that, it was almost, well, you know, we've kind of, we can do this other project that will hopefully get us to that movie that we want to make. Is that
actually? Yeah, it's pretty close. It's pretty accurate.
Yeah.
What happened was the Raid 2 in its very first incarnation was going to be a juvenile delinquent school film. Right. So it wasn't a prison movie film.
Okay.
It was a juvenile delinquent school film where the kid from the school had been recruited into the mob.
Right.
And he was just an ordinary guy. He wasn't an undercover cop. Yep. None of that going at all. And then what happened was that film, we could not get made for love nor money. We could not afford to do it. It was too big a budget.
This was after Maranto.
After Maranto. After Maranto, and I'd written this thing, and it was just called Barandal back then, which became the subheading for the Raid 2. And then one of the investors, this private investor, Irwan, as I call him, lovely guy, runs a Time watch shop in Indonesia, and he was very supportive of us from the beginning. And he just came out and he said, look, I can't justify spending that much money, but here's what I'll spend. And he gave me a number, and then he was like, if you've got a film that you can make which would come in at that number, then let's talk then. And that has incentivized me then. I was like, okay, give me some time, because I knew I didn't want to change Brandle that much. So I still wanted to make it as it was.
Yeah.
And then what happened was I started writing this other thing then, and that was The Raid. And I was a big fan of, like, you know, Assault and Precinct 13 and, you know, Rio Bravo. And then I took a look at Peace Hotel, which was the Chow Yun Fat film.
Yeah.
I was like, well, what if this was a high-rise, and what if it is off-limits to the cops? And this SWAT team go in there and they need to infiltrate because they need to take the boss down, but then they get locked in. And I was like, that's fun. And I remember thinking, like, we can make that quite cheap because then I can keep that all in the studio space.
Yeah, it's a single
and
set.
And we can build a corridor set and then we just change the numbers on the doors. Yeah, and that's 6th floor, 7th floor, 8th floor. We went back to him and said, this is what we want to do. And he was like, all right, cool. Yeah, go ahead and make it. And I was like, all right, great. So we went off and started making The Raid.
Yeah.
And in the process of making The Raid, I think we were probably like about a month or two into the making of it. I might remember this wrong now. I might have been doing the writing process, but I'm pretty sure it was when we were shooting it. That at one point on one day, I was looking at it and I was like, that Barandal script would probably be better if it was the guy was an undercover cop. And then I started like tweaking that script and I was like, what if this was an undercover cop? And then, what if it's this cop? And then it was like, and then I started to realize, so then when we were shooting The Raid 1, then I started tweaking the end script. So then Tama's last speech to the cop was mentioning about Reza and a few other corrupt cops who were superseding Wahyu. And so I was able to sow the seeds in and be like, ah, see, so that guy Reza, who we mentioned in the first one, was intentional, da 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 da, and now he's going to be this dodgy cop in part two, and Ico's character is going to come out from there, and they're going to wash that thing clean as if nothing ever happened.
Yeah.
And in order for him to be able to infiltrate the real corruption, which is the police department.
Yeah.
And so that became like the leaping off point, and then so I knew then that once we finished shooting the raid one, I would then be going straight in and starting to retrofit the script that already existed.
Yeah.
And probably, to be quite honest, I probably threw away about 60-70% of it.
The feedback on the raid, I know we touched on it earlier. I love the review from Bradshaw in The Guardian. I don't know if you read that one, 5-star review.
I'm a horrible, horrible sort of like avid reader.
Yeah, I read them all.
Yeah. It's a weird thing. I read everything, which is really annoying because It's such a cliche to say it, but the good stuff stays with you for about 5-10 seconds. The bad stuff stays with you for weeks. Right. It's awful. Yes. It's the worst.
He compares you to Park Chan-wook, Quentin Tarantino, John Carpenter. fluent, muscular, uninhibited. Across the board, The Raid is sort of held up as it's a modern martial arts classic. You made a classic.
it's weird. It's a weird feeling. It's like, like, you know, I hear the names of those three directors and just feel like, yeah, maybe in 20 years' time I might reach that level.
Yeah, that's how you feel.
Yeah, right? I mean, it's that thing. I've always felt like, it's that thing, it's saying, like when I said, you know, feeling like a charlatan because Jew does an encyclopedic knowledge of Hong Kong cinema. It's like, you know, I'll be if I'm ever in a room with another director, I'm just painfully aware of all of my artifice, and it's almost I feel like I'm an imposter in the room here. It's a weird feeling. It's like, you know, none of us expected the first film to get the reaction it did. So it's really humbling to kind of see the traces of it still now in certain films.
It's still referenced. Yeah. You know, we want this bit to be like The Raid. There's a remake of The Raid happening, which I'm sure you're aware of.
Yeah, allegedly.
But it's changed its name now, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's a fascinating turn of events. We'll see. I don't know. I mean,
are you involved in?
No. In all fairness, Joe and Frank, when they were first on board to do the official remake of it, back when it was official, they were very polite and called me up for their blessing, and I was like saying to them, guys, I mean, you know, I as a fan am excited to see what you bring to it.
Yeah.
Because for me it was like, it's the framework for, you know, inventive action set pieces.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's not Shakespeare. It's like it's an opportunity for people to go absolutely crazy with it, and, you know, you can come up with all sorts of different things. I know there were things that we wanted to do on the first raid that we just couldn't because we didn't have the budget for it.
Yeah.
Or ideas and little stunt set pieces that I was like, oh, we could do this. And then it comes to the realization of what that costs. And then you're like, maybe we do it a bit smaller.
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
But, you know, for Joe to kind of go off and do something like that would have been incredible. So, yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know what they're going to do next. I don't know how that's going to turn out.
Yeah.
It's an interesting approach, but yeah, we'll see.
Xiao Tin Shen will soon be dead. I've laid an ambush for him. Filthy traitor!
Did you think when you were making The Raid 2, this is probably the end? What was your thinking
The Raid 2 was like, in the most selfish, self-indulgent way possible, it was the one time where I got given sort of the keys and just being told to do what I want.
Yeah.
Because no one was really going to sort of like step in the way of that one because it was my own production company, so it'd be me to tell me no.
Yeah.
But it was just that everything was a bit bigger. The world was more expansive. I knew I wanted to do something different. I didn't want to do the whole thing of like, oh, it's another building, or it's a one story building.
Yeah.
No, you know, I knew it had to be something very, very different. And so we decided to expand the story, expand the action, the scope of it, and where we would take it. So out in the streets, vehicle work, shootouts, all of that stuff we wanted to throw into there.
The car chase was
that. Thank God for Bruce Law. What an amazing team he has, and he brought a lot to it and executed everything to a T for us. You know, we had a really great experience working with him. And then, you know, but it was that thing of how do we do something different? Because we couldn't do like a Fast and the Furious type car chase. Sure. You know, we wouldn't have the budget. You know, I saw one Fast and Furious film. It was probably the one with Joe in it, where I think somebody rode a tank over like seven cars in the space of 5 seconds. Sure. And I was like, shit, we didn't have seven cars for the entire sequence. We had six total for that whole sequence, where if one got trashed, the next one would come in. And then if that one got trashed, that's it. So, you know, we were on tent hooks every single day of the shoot for that stuff, you know. And so, doing a car chase was nerve-wracking but thrilling. And we had to find our way to do it. We had to find a way that we could do what we would normally do, find those little camera tricks. We do a lot of camera tricks to hide the more gonzo-feeling stunt elements. So we make it look a lot more dangerous than it actually is. When a car, you know, smashes straight into a brick wall and then the guy's body flies through the break and windscreen and lands on the bonnet.
Yeah.
That's four shots stitched together. You know, it's a car smashing into a wall where a guy's belted in as tight as he could possibly be with all of the sort of roll cage stuff going on in there. Then the camera's locked off and then we break the window open and then just throw silicon glass at the bonnet.
Yeah.
That's another element. And then the third element is a stunt guy then who's just stood on the seat and then throws himself through the hole in the windscreen and lands on the bonnet. And that's all it was. It was just like, but when you're watching on a run, you're like, oh my God, did that guy smash a car and project himself out?
Yeah. And with the sound as well, you use sound so well in your films.
Yeah, and that's down to Fada and Ogi, the boys who did the score and also the sound mix for those films.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, their attention to detail, and you know, we kept pushing them and pushing them and pushing them this and that. Obviously, the guys at Skywalker who did the sound mix actually for the Raid 2.
Yeah.
It was such a great attention to detail on all of those things that it just all comes together. And you know, and I think one of the unsung heroes as well is Andy Novianto, who's my VFX guy out in Indonesia.
Yeah,
he has like saved us so many times just by pulling things out of the bag all the time, where it's like, you know, I'd be like, I'm so sorry, I haven't got any tracking markers, but here's four shots, can you make them all look as one? And then he's like, Yeah, I told you to put markers on. Yeah, I know, but we ran out of time, or we couldn't be bothered to do it.
Yeah.
Can you just fix it for me, please? And Andy's fixed it so many times for us. Mm. Like, he's been an absolute trooper and an unsung hero across all of those films and everything I've done with him. So, yeah.
And now we'll see how good you are.
You're quite a humble guy.
Sometimes.
But, you know, what keeps your feet on the ground?
Friends and kids.
Yeah.
I've never looked to make the move out to where the industry is at all. So we went, when I remember saying I was going to leave Jakarta, I think my agents were all kind of excited about the prospect. Oh, great, so when you come in here? Yeah. I was like, I'm not going to go to LA. I'm gonna go as far as I could possibly be from any part of the industry. So I went further west into West Wales, And so for me, it was like, I'm not even in London, I'm not even in Cardiff, you know what I mean? So I'm a little further away from the industry in that respect. And it just keeps me, I like normality. I've not ever been like flashy as a person. Mm. I like the fact that, one of my close friends, when I showed him the trailer for Gangs, like his first reaction, because he just knows that he can take the piss constantly, he said like, oh, thank fuck, it's not like Apostle. You know, that's the first thing he said to me. Like, and I was like, oh, okay, great. You know what I mean? And then when I did the Raid, it was like, oh, thank fuck, there's nothing like Footsteps. Like the first thing I did. So like, you know, it's good to have friends that just don't really care or give a shit about what you do, because they just pull you back down to earth. And it's like, there's nothing, we're not curing diseases.
Yeah.
There's nothing really that special about what we do. It's just that I get to enjoy doing what I do. And that's
do you
it, really.
Fear that if you were to make that step, and maybe you will make that step eventually to, you know, move out to Los Angeles or whatever, do you foresee a future there where maybe you'd be part of that?
Really. No, not really. I think like for me, it's like I found a sweet spot in terms of what I like doing, in terms of what I like creating. And as long as I can keep the wheels moving on projects like that, I know where I'm best suited. I know what my budget range should be for the films I want to make and the things I want to do. And I think once I go to a certain level above that, that's when, you know, the films stop being the films that I want to give all of my heart to.
Yeah.
And I feel like if I start doing that, then that'll be the tipping point then. And it's like, I don't want to ever be in a situation where I look back on 10 years of my career and then think, oh, how did I get to here? Where did something go wrong? Did I that I derail from the path I wanted to keep. And I guess in a way it's always just hoping that whatever it is that I choose to do next, that there are enough people that want to see that.
Yeah.
You know, and you can never really guarantee that, but yeah. You know, just try your best, really.
Do you see yourself maybe branching off into other genres at some point?
Yeah, I think I would love to do... it's a lot of different films I'd love to end up doing at some point. I need to do a family adventure film. Yeah. I'd love to do that for my kids. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I have not done that yet.
Yeah.
So I'd love to do that. I've always said I'd love to do a musical at some point. Going back into action, weirdly, Western. I'd love to do a Western. Yeah. I think every filmmaker wants to make a Western at some point.
Yeah.
But I think I've come up with an idea that would be really unique for a Western. So, you know, I said I wouldn't do one until I come up with something that's a good idea for it. But I've been talking to Chris Webb again about a Western idea, and he seems to be quite taken by it. So we're going to develop a little something on that at some point as well.
Okay, fantastic.
But yeah.
We'll look forward to that. Gareth, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much. Appreciate
it. It's really cool. Thank you.
Nice one.
Gareth Evans there. Wonderful stuff. Such a nice, easygoing guy, and undoubtedly, in my opinion, at least one of the best and most exciting British directors that we do have working right now. I'm a huge fan of his work, obviously, and that was an absolute blast to be able to sit with him and record that conversation. We did actually end up being kicked out of that room that we were in at the Actors Centre because we'd been talking for so long. So I do hope you enjoyed listening to that. Gangs of London is his latest project. There are 9 episodes of the show, and they will all land on Sky Atlantic here in the UK on the 23rd of April. That's this Thursday. I will undoubtedly be binge watching that the second that it lands. It looks tremendous, and I'm super excited to see what Gareth and Matt and Jude have all cooked up for that show. You can, of course, keep up to date with all the latest Gareth Evans news by following Gareth on social media. He is on Instagram under the name @ghughevans. Okay, thank you all so much for listening to this episode of the show. Don't forget our competition. We've got a great competition this month, which runs until the 30th of April. We've teamed up with Eureka Entertainment here in the UK to give away Blu-rays of their new release of Zoo Warriors from the Magic Mountain. It's such a wonderful film, and it's great that Eureka have put this package together and given the film a high definition presentation, which is what it deserves. Sign up to our newsletter at kungfumovieguide.com to take part in this month's competition. And remember, if you do have any questions at all, or any feedback, or just something that you want to get off your chest and share with us, whatever it is, send it our way. We do love to hear from you. The email address is, as always, hello@kungfumovieguide.com. Okay, a huge thank you to Gareth for meeting up with me and chatting to me for this episode of the show, and a huge thank you to you for listening all the way to the very end. Thank you so much. As I said earlier, I do hope that these shows act as some kind of light relief during this particularly stressful time. I will be back with a new episode of the Kung Fu Movie Guide podcast in 2 weeks' time. In the meantime, take care, wash your hands, stay inside, follow whatever guidance it is that you're currently being told, help your neighbours, and most of all, stay safe wherever you are. I will see you next time on the Kung Fu Movie Guide podcast. Until then, take care, and bye for now.